ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। जय श्रीमद्भागवतम की जय। वी आर रीडिंग फ्रॉम श्रीमद्भागवतम कैंटो 10 चैप्टर नंबर 63 श्लोका नंबर 29 टुडे। श्री भगवान उवाच त्रिशीरस्ते प्रसन्नोऽस्मि वेतुते मज्वराद् भयम् यो नौ स्मरति संवादम् तस्य त्वन्न भवेद् भयम्। श्रीभगवानुवाच त्रिशिरस्ते प्रसन्नोऽस्मि व्येतुते मज्वराद् भयम् यो नौ स्मरति संवादम् तस्य त्वन्न भवेद् भयम्। श्रीभगवानुवाच त्रिशिरस्ते प्रसन्नोऽस्मि व्येतुते मज्वराद् भयम् यो नौ स्मरति संवादम् तस्य त्वन्न भवेद् भयम्। स्मरति संवादम् भवेद् भयम्। माताजी श्री भगवान उवाच येतुते मज्वराद् भयम् यो नौ स्मरति संवादम् तस्य त्वं न भवेद् भयम्। विल सी द वर्ड टू वर्ड ट्रांसलेशन। श्री भगवान उवाच द सुप्रीम लॉर्ड सेड त्रिशिरः ओ थ्री हेडेड वन ते विथ यू प्रसन्नः satisfied asmi I am vetu may it go away te your mat my jvarat of the fever weapon bhayam fear yah whoever now our smarati remembers संवादम द कन्वर्जेशन तस्य फॉर हिम त्वत ऑफ यू न भवेत देर विल नॉट बी भयम फियर। ट्रांसलेशन एंड परपोर्ट बाय द डिसाइपल्स ऑफ हिज डिवाइन ग्रेस ए सी भक्तिवेदांत स्वामी श्रील प्रभुपाद। ट्रांसलेशन द सुप्रीम लॉर्ड सेड O three-headed one, I am pleased with you. May your fear of my fever weapon be dispelled. And may whoever remembers our conversation here have no reason to fear you. Purport. Here the Lord accepts the Shiva Jwara as his devotee and gives him his first order that he should never frighten by hot fever those who faithfully hear this pastime of the Lord's. Om Ajnanatimirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupah Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitamscha. He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpataru Bhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhyayevacha Patitanam Pavane Bhyo Vaishnave Bhyo Namo Namaha. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishthaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nitinamine. Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaurabhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna. Before beginning to speak, I would like to seek the blessings of all the assembled devotees. So from the beginning of the Bhagavatam, we read about different devotees, Krishna. But one interesting thing is that we also read about different personalities who attack Krishna, who attack Vishnu. So from the beginning we have read about Hiranyaksha, we read about Hiranyakashipu, we read about Ravan, Kumbhakarna, their followers. In the 10th canto we have read about Shishupala and Dantavakra. Are there any other personalities in the Bhagavatam who attack Krishna or who attack Vishnu? Yes, right in the first canto there is Bhishma. So much before these big demons, Hiranyaksha, Hiranyakashipu and all, there is such a exalted personality, worshipable personality like Bhishma who attacks Krishna. And then we wonder, How can somebody like Bhishma attack Krishna? We can understand these demons like Hiranyaksha, Hiranyakashipu, the immoral people. They wanted to claim God's property as their own. To some extent it did also. So when they attack Krishna, it's understood. But how can Bhishma attack Krishna? He has such high values. So, one might feel that, okay, maybe something went wrong. But then after that duel, we also hear Bhishma offering choice prayers to Krishna. So he is a devotee. He is a nice person. So evil people attacking God fits into our brains. But good people, moral people, and the height of morality is becoming a devotee of Krishna. So Bhishma is not just moral on the social level. He is moral on the spiritual level also. He is a devotee of the Supreme Lord. So how can he attack Krishna? So this is Bhagavatam. You know, it challenges our conceptions. Anybody who comes to the Bhagavatam class with his own conceptions, he will find his conceptions challenged. Yes. So many times, I've seen some listeners to the Bhagavatam class getting uncomfortable. So at some point of the time in the class, you know, it becomes uncomfortable. So what is he speaking? You know, yes, because so many conceptions that we have about enjoyment, about the utility of this world, the connection of ourselves with the Lord, they get challenged when we hear the Bhagavatam class. So we become restless sometimes. So Bhagavatam here in this section puts this stark reality right in our faces. What is that? The material world is definitely not a good place. But the typical reasons that we hear about why this material world is not a good place is the uncertainties of this world. Anything can happen anytime. There is contamination here. And in this way, different devotees can come up with different reasons to justify how this world is not a good place. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, the material world is not a fit place for a gentleman. But in this section, one strong factor that comes up to describe the unsuitability of this material world for us is that the material world is so contaminating, it is so bad, that what to speak of ordinary people becoming envious of Krishna, ignorant people becoming envious of Krishna. Sometimes the situation can be so bad, that's how the world is, unfortunately, that even good devotees can attack Krishna. You would not expect them to do that. But this is what it is. Here is Lord Shiva. Who is Lord Shiva? Lord Shiva is the greatest Vaishnava, but we are seeing it. That Lord Shiva here is attacking Krishna. Before this, Lord Brahma has attacked the powers of Krishna. He did not attack the person Krishna. But he was thinking, how can this boy do this? Before that, Indra has attacked Krishna. Yes? So who is Bhishma, who is Indra, who is Brahma and who is Shiva? We keep them in one category. Yes, they are servants of the Supreme Lord. When the demons do this, we can understand. But yes, the material world is so bad. This is a signal to us. Try to understand the reality of this material world. No matter how good we are and no matter how much we feel we are very good, we are very nice devotees, we are now mature devotees, we are up there somewhere. But these examples are to tell us this world is not a good place. So think about it. How can somebody attack the very person whom you love? What makes a person go against the object of your worship? So Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, you know, they have offered prayers. They have done Navida Bhakti, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam and all that. And at one point of time, after all that, it comes out that now they are attacking the person whose names they are chanting. Yes? So it's very interesting how this world is very difficult to exist in. We have our own difficulties in a very small way. And sometimes they become overwhelming for us. We say, how can this happen to me? Think about this. In the morning you chant Hare Krishna and in the evening you go and attack that person.
So what am I doing? This was Arjun's argument. Arjun said, you know, you are asking me to attack them. They are worthy of my worship. Puja arahao. So you want me to kill those people, attack those people to whose feet I am used to offer flowers in worship. They are my guru. This is my grandfather. How can I do this? So Arjun's predicament, sometimes because we are reading the Gita and sometimes we have also heard that there is a gradation of scripture. So Gita, then Bhagavatam comes and Chaitanya Charitamrita comes. Sometimes some devotees may lose, you know, that situational understanding of the Gita. That what is the Gita? What is the predicament that Arjun faced? The predicament that Arjun faced is, in one sense, you know, it is similar to Prahlad's predicament. Prahlad and Arjun both are devotees and their family members are non-devotees. So Prahlad's immediate family members, Hiranyakashipu, his friends, his teachers, everyone is against Vishnu. In that sense, Arjun's family members, immediate family members were devotees of Vishnu, but everyone else is against Vishnu, Krishna. So Prahlad, you know, he's all alone there. There is nobody around him. And from that perspective, he is facing a more difficult situation than Arjun. Why? Because Arjun at least had the support of his mother and the four brothers and his wife. Other than them, it's very difficult. But from another perspective, Arjun's situation is much more difficult than Prahlad's. Why? Because Prahlad was never expected to kill Hiranyakashipu. What was expected from Prahlad? Being a small child, you just tolerate. So what did he do? You know, they're attacking him, they're teaching him, they're doing everything. He's just tolerating. He's just keeping quiet. So when Shanta and Amarka are teaching him, he's just keeping quiet and remembering Vishnu. When they do all nonsense to him, he's just remembering. Hiranyakashipu is asking him, what did you learn? So he's saying, okay, this is it. But he never revolted against his father. Yes, this is seen as good culture. He never spoke harshly. On the other hand, Krishna is telling Arjun, not only you tolerate, he's saying, don't tolerate. So he's saying, I want to tolerate. Yes, let people do nonsense to me, but I will tolerate. I'm a Vaishnava. But he's saying, don't tolerate. You kill them. This is a much bigger test. So it's a personal test. That how can you attack those people whom you love? And second test is, the whole world will spit on you. What an ungrateful disciple. What an ungrateful son. What an ungrateful grandson you are. These people gave you love. These people taught you. And the fruit of all that is, you killed them. So can you understand what is going on in Arjun's mind? So it's very amazing how Arjun can handle these situations. So something like that, you know, we can see here how, here we are trying to understand how Shiva also can attack Krishna. In 12.17 or 12.18 Gita, Krishna says, Yo na rishyati na dveshti, na shochati na kangshati, shubha ashubha parityagi, bhakti mana same priya. So he is saying, shubha ashubha parityagi. So it's very interesting how, you know, we have our understanding of what is shubha and ashubha in this world. So we want to stick to the shubha and we want to give up the ashubha. But Krishna is saying, now this instruction is obviously not for everyone because it's a bhakti man, shakti man, bhakti man. Bhakti man means he possesses bhakti. So this instruction is only for devotees and that too, you know, for somebody like Arjun, he's saying, shubha ashubha parityagi. So who is a devotee? He is telling Arjun right in his face, a devotee is a person who gives up shubha and ashubha both. So Arjun is saying, in the beginning of the war, he says, ashubha I can take care of, but these people are shubha. These people have given me auspiciousness in my life. How can I? He says, no, if I am telling you, be detached from shubha and ashubha both, because shubha and ashubha, both will bring bondage to this world, and I want to free you from this bondage of this world. Now one interesting thing is, of the six qualities of bhakti, the second one is shubhada. Yes? And Krishna is saying, you give up shubha and ashubha, and then bhakti will give you shubhada. It will give you shubha. It is a giver of shubha. It means there are two levels of shubha. When Krishna is saying shubha, shubha parityagi, that shubha is shubha of this material world. That auspiciousness based on the three modes, temporary, can change. What is auspicious today can become inauspicious tomorrow. But the shubhada that is mentioned in the nectar of devotion, that shubhada is not based on the three modes. That shubhada is eternal shubhada. That is beyond the bodily platform. So that is Vritrasura's point. Vritrasura is telling Indra, you kill me, you get Shubha of this world. You become the king of this world. I'll die and I'll get Shubha of the spiritual world. Both will get their own Shubha. So, you know, this is the challenge that at one point of time we'll all face. That the situation can become so intense that we might have to go against those people whom we adore. So we'll deal with this thing that what is this phenomenon where a devotee can rebel against the Supreme Lord? We'll try to discuss this. There are different types of people who have attacked Krishna. So we have tried to group them into four categories. The first category is the foolish or the faithless people. So the examples that we have chosen is Duryodhan, Shishupal. They're so foolish, they cannot understand what is happening. So when Krishna, he goes as the Shanti Dut, he shows the universal form. But Duryodhan feels it is some magic or something. Krishna is a magician. Shishupal, he never doubted the person Krishna. But whenever he would hear the glories of Krishna, then he would think, oh, it is just some creativity. It is just some person blowing up the account. He did something very ordinary and now people are saying that he did something great. So we could say they are foolish or faithless. In one sense, Shishupal directly attacked the Lord, but Duryodhan did something more severe. Duryodhan never attacked Krishna. Duryodhan attacked those whom Krishna loved. So Krishna mentions at one point in Mahabharata that your problem is not that you are against me, your problem is a greater problem. Your problem is that you are against those who love me and whom I also love. So this is the first category. The second category is the negligent or the blind people. So one example in this category is Jarasandh. He attacks Krishna. Krishna and Balaram, just the two boys, they come out and destroy 23 Akshahoni armies. So just to give you a scale, Mahabharata was 17 Akshahoni, the entire put together. And this is 23 Akshahoni. So Krishna and Balaram, the two young boys, around the age of 11, they totally massacre this army 17 times. It comes, Balaram captures him, Krishna says, no, let him go. He goes, brings back. In this way, it is happening right in front of him. When Krishna lifted Govardhan, Shishupal was not present. So he had some chance of disbelieving it. But Jarasandh, it is happening right in front of him. But he is just negligent, he is blind. He does not understand who is Krishna. The third category is the purposeful, committed enemies of Krishna. So one example that we have is Kamsa. He heard the unembodied voice, Akashvani. A Akrura tried to convince him. What to speak of all that, the personified material energy, Durga Devi personally came in front of him and told him, Krishna cannot be killed by you. In fact, you are supposed to be killed by Krishna. But somehow, he hears it, he understands it, but still he says, I will kill Krishna. He's purposeful. He says, no. I'm going to kill Krishna. They try to put sense into his senseless brain, but it does not work. And the fourth category is the ignorant category. Ignorant means there is a thick curtain of material energy that blocks their vision. Maya Javanika Achannam. Who are the people in this category? We could say Kaliya. Look, till the time Krishna actually started fighting, for some time Kaliya still felt that he's just an ordinary boy. Even when Krishna jumped into the Kaliya Daha, the lake in which Kaliya was there, it is mentioned water just spilled out just by that one jump and it went 10 meters on the land. So that was the impact created by Krishna's jump into Yamuna River. And that those vibrations went up to the home of Kaliya deep in that lake. But still, for some time, quite some time, he fought thinking that it's ordinary. Only when Krishna started dancing and putting his feet on his head, then he understood the power of Krishna. We could also count Indra, Brahma in this category. That they saw Krishna, but they're ignorant. How can a simple cowherd boy who eats the remnants of his friends. How can he be the Supreme Lord? So they're ignorant. There is a illusory energy working on them. Now in Dwarka, you know, the queens of Dwarka, they stayed so close to Krishna. But they could never understand who is Krishna. They would always feel, oh, Krishna just follows us like an ordinary husband. So maybe he is also ordinary. Because of their affectionate smiles and their sincere attitude of service, Krishna appeared to be controlled by them. And so they could not understand who is Krishna. So think about it. There are queens of Dwarka who are constantly living with Krishna. They could not understand who Krishna is. So what to speak of people like Indra and Brahma who just observe Krishna from a distance in Vrindavan. It is a land of simplicity. The powers are hidden. They could not understand Krishna. So Indra, when the news reaches him that Krishna has stopped the sacrifices due to him, then he speaks three shlokas. In his anger, there are outbursts of words from him. So we'll just read that. He says, Aho Shri Madamahatmyam Gopanam Kananaukasam Krishnam Martyam Upashritya Ye Chakrur Devahelanam. So the first word, you know, the first words that come out of him, he's saying, Krishnam Martyam Upashritya. He calls Krishna as a Martya. Martya means mortal, an ordinary boy. So he is calling Krishna, Krishnam Martyam. These Vrajvasis, who do they think they are? Ye Chakrur Devahelanam. I am a devata, I am such a powerful person. You have insulted me for this ordinary boy. I'll teach you a lesson. Then the second shloka that he speaks, he says, anybody who tries to, you know, go against the devatas, it is just like somebody trying to cross the material world by ritualistic sacrifices. So it's a philosophical shloka. In the third shloka, he attacks Krishna. The first shloka, he attacked the devotees of Krishna, describing their foolishness. But still he called Krishna as Martyam, ordinary. Third shloka, he says, Vachalam balisham stabdham agyam panditam anina Krishnam Martyam upashritya gopa me chakru apriyam. Again he speaks the same words, Krishnam Martyam upashritya. So it's very clear, he is thinking, this is an ordinary boy, he's an ordinary boy, he's an ordinary boy. I am a devata, I am a devata, I am a devata. He's trying to show the contrast between what he wants the Vrajvasis to do, worship an exalted demigod, and what they are doing right now, worshipping an ordinary little boy. I'll show you who I am. And then we know what happens. He shows his full power. Krishna lifts the Govardhan hill. He's humiliated. And then he comes and offers his prayers with the help of Surbhi cow. And the first shloka that he speaks, what is the first shloka that Indra speaks? He says, Vishuddha Sattvam Tavadhama Shantam. The first words that Indra speaks in remorse is, Vishuddha Sattvam Tavadhama Shantam. So Srila Sridhar Swami, one of our acharyas, he analyzes this word dhama, not the typical understanding of dhama, the holy place. Dhama here refers to the body of Krishna. And he has given different proofs. If you want, you can read the purport of that shloka. So the point that I am making is, in the three shlokas that he speaks, in anger, twice Krishna is called as Martyam. And after the whole episode, the first word that Indra speaks is, Vishuddha Sattvam, your body is. Your body is not Martyam. Now I realize this. Your body is beyond the three modes. Your body is spiritual body. So that veil, it took a lot of energy, it took a lot of things to happen for that material veil where he saw Krishna as Martyam. Who is Martyam, by the way? Between Indra and Krishna, who is Martyam? It is Indra who is Martyam. But he calls Krishna as Martyam. But then, when he is given the proper shock treatment, then that amnesia that he has, it goes away and then he understands, no, he is not Martyam, I am Martyam, he is Vishuddha Sattvam. So similarly, we see how Lord Brahma also, he misunderstood. He tried to test Krishna. So what makes a devotee do unthinkable things? How can a devotee do that? So in different devotees like Indra, Brahma, Shiva, we see different factors. So we are trying to analyze that. Let's consider one approach. So one approach is, how do you react in a particular situation depends on what you have inside you. What is my substance? This is the mango season. So, if I give you a mango and you squeeze that mango, what comes out? Mango juice. If I give you an orange and you squeeze that orange, what comes out? Orange juice. Would orange juice ever come out of a mango? No. Would mango juice ever come out of an orange? No. In this way, for all fruits. It means what is inside comes out when you squeeze that fruit. Similarly, what comes out when life squeezes us? So, try to think of the situation when it could be anybody. It could be your friend, it could be your relatives, it could be some of your family members, it could be one of your colleagues in office, any other person. When they put pressure on you, when there's some, it could be a perceptional pressure, it could be intentional pressure. But what happens when you are put under pressure, when life squeezes you? So if you think about it, and if the answer is frustration, if the answer is anger, resentment, rebellion, then it gives a small hint at what is there inside us. Yes. Because that is what is inside us. So when life squeezes us, that is what comes out. So how do you change? What is our response in stressful situations when life squeezes us? How do we change our situation? We change our situation by changing the substance inside. It's just natural that when suddenly things go out of your hand, the natural person inside pops out. So if you really want to be a gentleman, if you really want to control yourself in disturbing situations, what we do is we try to control life. We try to control the person whom we perceive as putting pressure on us. That's the typical way of handling pressure. That's the typical way of handling disturbing situations. Very simple. Orange juice comes out of orange. So if we change the substance inside us, then when life squeezes us, then it won't come out in that way. Yes. So if there is something good inside us, then that good thing will come out. Another way to understand what happens, what is it that determines how we react in certain situations? One another situation we would like to consider is Dhruv Maharaj's case. So his brother, he is killed by one of the yakshas. So yakshas are one category of living entities in the universe. They have subtle bodies, different than humans. So these yakshas, they kill his brother when he goes to the forest. And Dhruv Maharaj is angered by it. And Dhruv Maharaj alone goes to the abode of the yakshas. It is called Alaka Puri. So he just blows his conch shell, and the vibration of that conch shell disturbs all the yakshas. And even though he is all alone, Dhruv is all alone, all the yakshas come together and they attack Dhruv. But Dhruv is also not to be outdone. He is not an ordinary person. He gives a strong resistance to their attack. He gives them a good fight. But at one point of time, even if he overpowers them by his skills, but the yakshas, they have some magical, mystical powers. So they create some kind of an illusion. And it appears that there is a big sea of wild animals, tigers, lions, elephants are there. And that sea, it's almost like up to the sky, and with a big roaring noise, it is attacking him. And for a moment, because it's all a big, huge illusion, Dhruva is bewildered. And Dhruva thinks, now what to do? So at that time, some sages, the voice comes and they tell him, these are the yakshas, this is not real, this is illusion. Try to remember the Supreme Lord who is beyond illusion. And he chants the holy names and all that illusion is dispelled. And then he takes the Narayan Astra and then starts fighting with his yakshas again. So, at one point of time, because he's just killing all those yakshas, his grandfather, Swayambhuva Manu, he appears there and he tells Dhruv Maharaj, you have gone beyond your limits. He uses the word Ati Roshena. Ati Roshena means you have become excessively angry. So he says, please stop fighting. saying only one yaksha killed your brother. You have far more than that taken revenge. You have killed thousands and unlimited yakshas. So you already set a good punishment, a good standard for them. Now it's enough, you stop. He gives many reasons. He says, you are already a devotee, you have already seen the Supreme Lord. Why would you engage in such activities? So the same theme. Why would somebody who is so pure engage in an activity which is not considered to be good? And what is the response of Dhruva Maharaj? Dhruva Maharaj immediately stops. Dhruva Maharaj does not argue. And the result of that is, the leader of the Yakshas, Kuvera, when he appears in front of Dhruva Maharaj, he is very happy and he says, I am so happy with you because you immediately ceased fighting when your seniors told you to fight. So when you were fighting, it seemed that you are not going to stop. But just because one person told you, stop, you stopped. Immediately he stops. So he says, I am supremely pleased with you. Ask something. Who is this Kuvera? Kuvera is the treasurer of the demigods. He is the same person from whom that whole big golden city was stolen by Ravan. That famed city. So that person asking, what do you want? And what is Dhruv's background? Dhruv's background is, he is a perfect sadhaka. He is a committed sadhaka. For 6 months, his Guru Maharaj, Narad Muni, told him, you chant this mantra, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, and you do this austerity. He stuck to the finest detail. He did all the tapasya and he chanted Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So as far as his sadhana goes, there is not one small fault in his sadhana. And the fruit of that sadhana is, he achieved something that so many devotees have never achieved. Narad Muni glorifies him like that later. Sunite Suputra. That the son of Suniti achieved something which the great devotees, 6 months of intense tapasya and following the orders of his spiritual master, both put together, what more could you ask for? And he gets the darshan of the Supreme Lord. So who is Dhruv who went beyond his limits? Dhruv is perfect in his sadhana. He followed his spiritual master and the Supreme Lord personally became happy on him. But even such a person at one point of time crossed the limits of gentlemanliness. He took excessive revenge against his enemies. So to understand what makes a good person behave in an improper way, this question has been, you know, people are dealing with this question even in modern times also. So in Stanford University, which is one of the top universities, in 1971 they did a very famous experiment. This experiment is called the Stanford Prison Experiment. So the psychology professor there, he had 75 students under him. He took 24 out of them who were psychologically stable. He analyzed them before. And these 24 psychology students were allotted randomly two roles. One was a prison guard role and one was a prison inmate role. So they created a mock prison in the basement of their building where they would study psychology. And in that mock prison, 12 people became fake guards and 12 people became fake inmates. And there were cells created just to study. So the US Navy, they sponsored this study because they wanted to understand what is the reason why in prisons all over USA, the prison inmates always have a clash with the guards. Why can't they just accept we are in the prison and for the next so many years we need to obey the orders of the prison guards. Let's be good people inside the prison and then we can go out. But it seems prisoners are having a lot of clashes with the prison guards. So they wanted to understand what is it that makes a person behave improperly even when he is told you are here for rectification. So the study was originally meant to go on for 2 months. And all of those participants were paid a certain amount per day. What happened was very amazing. It was observed that those who were playing the role of prison guards, as days went by, they became more and more authoritarian. Authoritarian means they sank more and more into the role of an authority. They're ordinary students. But they became like heavy and more and heavy and more. The first day, there was some kind of a rebellion by the prison inmates. What these people did was, they started beating them up. And one or two people out of the prison inmates, you know, they showed some good behavior that they did not side with the rebellion. So these two people were given special facilities in the form of a special meal and like that. And the other people, they were taken to, you know, some smaller cells and their sanitary conditions were lowered. One person, he expressed doubts during this experiment to the prison guard. He said, you know, isn't it getting too far that this was just supposed to be an ordinary experiment and now you, all of you are becoming too heavy? The guard put him into solitary confinement. He stopped meals for him. He had a mattress to sleep on the concrete floor. He took away the mattress also. So, the guards went deeper and deeper into the mood of a authority, and something interesting happened. The people who were playing the role of the prison inmates, they went deeper and deeper into depression. They actually absorbed themselves into that role. And the whole experiment had to be called off after 7 days. So August 14 to August 20, 1971 in Stanford, this experiment was conducted and they just stopped it. Now, another interesting thing is, who stopped it? So the professor who was playing the role, who was conducting this experiment, he was also part of the experiment. He was playing the role of the superintendent of that jail. He also got involved. At one point of time, the prison guards, they reported to him, you know, look at these people, they don't follow our orders. So there was some, you know, there was a situation that one of the person who was released, he said, I don't want to, like, so they released him. So there was some rumor that he's going to come with his friends and he's going to stop this experiment. So the professor shifted for one day that mock prison to the top floor of that building and he was waiting if somebody comes. And then it did not happen. So again he brought, so it went out of hand. So another expert, when he learned that there is some experiment happening like this in the basement, he came and he told this person, try to understand, they have gone beyond limits. They have gone beyond limits, and you, because you are also part of that experiment, you are not a neutral observer, you are also affected by this. Try to understand this. And then it hit him and it was stopped in 7 days. Now similar to this, there was another experiment conducted in Yale University in 1961. So in 1961, in April, one of the top Nazi leaders was caught. His name was Adolf Eichmann. He was one of the main, you could say, the main right-hand person of Adolf Hitler. So he's the brainchild behind all the tortures. Hitler would just give orders. When he was caught, then they wanted to understand this, that when a person inflicts torture upon fellow human beings, is it because he is inherently evil? Or is it because he has been given orders to perform evil? So to understand this, one professor of psychology in Yale, he conducted a famous experiment called as Milgram experiment. This was conducted in 1961. So in 61, what he did was, there were three people involved. One is the experimenter, the person who's doing the experiment. One is somebody called as a teacher, and one is a student. And there were two rooms, separated by a wall. In one room was the person who would give the teaching lessons. One person would speak it to the student, and the student was sitting in another room. They could not see each other, but they could communicate each other by voice. So the main person, he would tell the teacher, he would give a list of word pairs. So two words that are connected to each other, he gave a list and said, now your job is to teach these two words to the student. How he would do is through the microphone, and the other student would hear it. Now, the experiment was, he said, the student who is sitting in the other room, there is a wrist strap put around his wrist. So when you teach him two words that are connected to each other, then you ask him at the end, did you learn it? He says, yes. So, okay, tell me the two words which are connected to each other. So for a correct answer, there was a reward. But if you give a wrong answer, the teacher who was teaching, he was told, you can press this button. And this button would give an electric shock to the student sitting in the other room. And that long list, every wrong answer, the voltage would be increased by 15 volts. So the topmost limit that was kept was 450 volts. So there was a facility kept to keep on pressing the button, and the teacher knows that every time I press the button, the voltage will be increased by 15 volts and the top is 450 volts. Now the most interesting thing was, the student was faking it. He was part of that experiment, so that wrist and all was true, but there was no electric shock actually. So they set up an audio equipment on the other side, which would correspond to the cry or to the shout of a person when he would be given that shock. So certain sounds were recorded. So he presses the button, let's say 30 volts. So 30 volts, how would a person, like that. So then that sound would come to the teacher back and he would think that I actually gave a shock to the student, but there was no such shock. So at extreme voltages, the student was told, you start banging on the wall, saying this is too high for me. And let's see if the person who's pressing the button, who's in an authority figure, who's a teacher, who's teaching to the students, does he stop? So is he inherently evil, or is the situation making him evil? The teacher was told, this is an experiment conducted by the psychology professor, so you are not responsible for what happens. So you are giving electric shocks and there could be certain harm to the student, but finally this is not all being done by you. So even if something goes out of hand, you are not responsible. You are a clean person before the experiment and you are a clean person after the experiment. So it was found out, for 40 teachers they did this experiment, they found out around 26 people, they went beyond limits. It was found out that 1/3 of these people, they actually expressed sadistic tendencies. Sadism means to take pleasure in another person's pain. 1/3 of these students, they experienced pleasure when they heard cries coming from that other room. And Milgram, he later, just to understand, is it a universal understanding, he conducted a similar experiment in different countries and the situation was different. Like here is what teacher and student. Very surprisingly, all over the world, wherever they conducted these experiments, it must have been the Western world primarily, the number of people who crossed the limits was always between 61% and 66%. So in USA, Yale, it was 60. So the Yale students, the Ivy League students, we are going to have one very exalted speaker today evening, who is also from Yale, the top-notch people. 65% in Yale expressed that tendency to go beyond limits when they are given an authority. And all over the world, the figure was 61 to 66. So the result of these two studies independently performed was that, to a great extent, behavior has situational attribution, not psychological attribution. What it means is that if a situation is created, people will behave in a way that is not good. But if a good situation is created, then good people will behave in a good way. If a bad situation is created, good people can also behave in a bad way. So in the context of these studies, we wanted to present, coming back to that fruit analogy, because we are talking about that fruit, when it is squeezed, what comes out. So yes, one approach says, whatever is inside will come out. It does not depend on the situation. And in Dhruv Maharaj's case, in these two experiments case, it seems the situation overpowered the inherent goodness in these personalities. So how do we understand this? So I was thinking about this. Is it disconnected? Is it connected? So I would like to present something. That yes, the fruit, when you squeeze it, what is inside comes out. But how does the inside of the fruit get formed? So if you are talking of a mango, when the mango is plucked raw from the tree and it is not exposed to the sun, what happens is it rots. A raw mango, you just keep it, it rots. What happens if a fruit is overexposed to the sun? Then also it spoils. So, for the inside substance to become, to transform from sour substance to sweet substance, there is an external situation that is also required. So, if you expose the fruit to good amount of sun, then the external situation ripens the sour mango, an unripe mango, into a ripe mango properly. But if you don't have a proper situation, then the mango will either spoil or it will rot. It means, yes, what is inside comes out, and what is outside affects what is inside. So all of us, we have inherent goodness. Pitaham asya jagato, Krishna says. We are inherently good as a spirit soul, Sat, Chit and Ananda, we are inherently good. But the situation in which we keep ourselves, that situation has the ability to change our inherent qualities. And that is what we call as the three modes. The three modes are tossing us up and down at different times. So the Vedic culture, you know, there are two things that the Vedic culture offers us. The Vedic culture offers us instructions in the form of the Vedas, but it also provides a good situation, an environment, what we typically call as culture, in which it is possible to live by those instructions. So if you just think about it, if somebody just gives you instructions, do this, do this, do this, but he does not, or there is no facility in which you can live by those instructions, it's actually very painful. So there are four situations that can come. The four situations are, there is an availability of instructions, and there is also a cultured society in which you can live by those instructions. So the advantage of such a situation is that even somebody who has heard a little bit of instructions, he gets a lot of inspiration to live by high standards. There is a lot of possibility that even the most ordinary person can also elevate himself to good behavior, to good culture, and he can become a very nice gentleman. He can actually develop humility, simplicity and so on, as mentioned in the Gita. Krishna compares knowledge to a sword in the Gita. But in this world, when we see, the sword is always kept in a cover, it is always kept in a sheath, yes? So we can understand knowledge when it is unprotected. It's like a sword, but a sword, if it is unprotected, can cause harm. So that's why to protect the sword, it is kept in the sheath. Similarly, knowledge has to be protected by good culture. If good knowledge falls in the hands of wrong culture, it can create a lot of damage. So when non-gentlemanly people have access to very sophisticated scientific knowledge, they only use it for destruction. When you keep the sword protected, it prevents it from harming others. So similarly, when there is a culture in which knowledge is protected, it prevents misapplication of that knowledge. At the same time, when you keep a sword in a cover, it also keeps it sharp, because it won't develop blunt edges. It means good culture keeps knowledge protected such that it is instantly available whenever it is needed. Otherwise, when you need instructions, when you need knowledge, and the person says, well, I don't remember exactly what to tell you, so then there is an urgency, but there is no knowledge available. That is why there is no shortage of recommendations amongst devotees. Have good association, have good association. So we'll take three examples from Dhruva Maharaj's story. Suruchi, we can say, is like this. She has good knowledge, but she also provides a good culture. How do we understand this? When Dhruva Maharaj came hissing like a snake to Suniti, his mother, then Suniti, the first words that she tells him is, don't become envious of the person who caused you trouble. So she is providing a good culture, but she also gives good instructions that don't just keep quiet. No envy. No, you go to the forest and pray to the Supreme Lord. Another way in which we can understand the culture that Suniti gave to Dhruv is, you know, tiny children, small children, they are very prone to throwing tantrums. They demand something, you say no, and they start fighting, they start kicking their feet, they start banging their fists, typical of a small child. So when Dhruv, the stepmother of Dhruv, told him, you can't sit here, get lost, one would expect Dhruv to throw a tantrum there. My father, how can I not say it? Who are you? Something he should have done. But there is no mention. What happened is, his ego was pained. Straight he walked from that room to his mother. And he said, mother, what to do? So this shows Suniti has trained her child properly. There is samskaras, there is culture. He did not behave like an ordinary child. Even though the situation was not ordinary, it was extraordinary. So that shows this. And in modern times we can say, you know, we are comparing, there are four situations, so we are comparing. This is the Bharat Varsha, the past India. So in past India, there is knowledge available in the form of Vedas, but there is also very strong culture in which people live by the knowledge of the Vedas. The second situation is only instructions but no culture. So think about it, when somebody gives you instructions but there is no culture, it actually becomes painful. You say, hey, you are just instructing me, where is the facility to live by those principles? You are asking me to become humble. Who is humble? He is not humble. She is not humble. They are not humble. How can I be humble amongst non-humble people? It's quite painful actually. You go to a railway station and then there are these notice boards saying, keep the railway clean. So you decide, okay, I'll keep the railway clean. You see some litter, you pick it up. So where is the dustbin? Yes. There's no dustbin for a long distance. So you say, I want to follow. The instruction is there to keep it clean. But where is the dustbin? So if the dustbins are not provided, it causes frustration. Yes. So in modern times, you know, people say, an honest criminal is better than a dishonest policeman. This is the Western thought process. So chori karta hai, lekin usko puchenge to bolta hai, main chori karta hoon kyunki main gareeb hoon. Lekin look at this policeman, he's supposed to be an honest person, but he's a dishonest person. This is worse. This is a modern thought process. When Clinton, at one point of time when he was the president of USA, he did something which was not supposed to be done. And then the whole country was thinking, what is he going to do now? And he accepted it. He said, yes, yes, I have done it. The whole country supported him. The whole country said, at least he's honest. At least he's accepting what he did. So this is the modern thought process. So we can say, this is the West, around 40 to 50 years back, where there were only instructions, but no culture to live by those instructions. And in that Dhruvamana story, we can say it is Suruchi. Suruchi give very strong instructions. Don't sit here. But culture, is this culture? To a 5-year-old child, you are a stepmother, instead of giving love and affection. Okay, don't give love and affection. At least behave neutrally. At least write not on his face. So she is a person who represents this mentality that you give instructions, but you do not worry about providing a culture in which that person can live by those instructions. Harsh speech. Right speech, right instructions, but delivered in the most heartbreaking way. The third situation is only environment, but no instructions. So you provide a very good environment, everyone is very nice, but there is no training. Nobody speaks, you should do this, you should do that. What happens usually is, in such an environment, people get spoiled. But there's so much facility, nobody speaks anything. But if somebody wants to learn, what to do now? There's no training given. So that is only environment, but no instructions. Many Indians, in India when they are there, they do not appreciate the value of Indian culture. Indian culture is a very cultured society. So when they go to the West, when they see how people talk with each other, how people don't have trust on each other, say, "Arey, wo main udhar rehta tha. No, India, I could trust people." So India was such a nice place. Many Indians, they develop appreciation for Indian culture only when they reach the West. If you open a bottle of perfume, you know, that strong whiff that comes off, actually you get put off. Yes, perfume can be appreciated only from a distance. So similarly, you know, Indian culture, Vedic culture is like a very fragrant perfume. But since we are part of it, we feel like, you know, I'm fed up of this culture. People always trying to ask, are you okay? Is everything all right? Just let me alone. I'm okay. Only when you go to the West, nobody cares for you. Nobody loves you. Nobody even asks you. Then you understand, I think those times were good. So you appreciate perfume only from a distance. So we can compare Uttanapad to this. Uttanapad is a very good father. Why? Because when Dhruv Maharaj came back, he went from his kingdom and embraced Udhru on the way. But when the need was there, there were no instructions only. So when Suruchi is harshly speaking to Dhruv, she is telling him, get lost. Uttanapad should have at least stopped her. Uttanapad should have at least comforted Dhruv. Okay, we'll talk later. You know, she is like this only. What to do? She cannot be trained. Something as a solace for Dhruv. There's no words spoken by Uttanapad. Silence killed the situation. So this is a situation where there is a good culture, good father, but no instructions. He could not save through. And the last situation, which is very bad, is no environment and no instructions. This is the modern West. There is no environment. Nobody trusts anybody. There is no relationships between people. And nobody knows what to do to improve the situation. They're completely lost. One of my brahmachari friends in the ashram, he told me, one of his friends, not a devotee, in his college. So, he went to the US and he, Indian body, but he's married a Croatian immigrant girl in the US. So, she is from Croatia, but they got married in the US. So, and he was, that friend was explaining to my friend, that why would a Croatian girl staying in the US get married to an Indian boy who's not from Croatia, who's not from US. So she said, I have studied in US and I have understood these American boys, they are not ready for long-term commitment. Yes. So they go around with you, have fun with you. But marriage is not just about the 5 years of enjoyment, it's about long-term relationships. She said, I'm not sure whether if I marry a American boy, you know, he's going to stay with me for my whole life. I know Indians. Indians are committed. So she has taken a risk because he is also an immigrant. He is not a permanent resident of India. Yes, his visa is an Indian visa. But she is, whatever said and done, you will have deeper commitment to me as a wife. So it's a clear indication that in US, you know, that all that glamour, actually it fades away when it comes to personal relationship. So no instructions and no environment. So in our case, you know, we have received the gift from Srila Prabhupada, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. There's so many instructions in the form of his books. Thick purports. So imagine, you know, one thing which I felt was, his Guru Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada's Guru Maharaj, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, what were his instructions to Srila Prabhupada? First meeting he told him, why don't you preach this message in the English speaking language, in the English speaking part of the world. On the banks of Radhakund, he said, if you ever get money, print books. Second instruction. Third instruction in that letter that Prabhupada wrote just before his demise, before he left this world, he wrote, what do you want me to do? He said, if you ever get money, print books. And if you do this, it will do good to you. So three times, there was an interaction between Guru Maharaj and Srila Prabhupada. Three times Guru Maharaj told him, print books. Speak in English language. Did Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati give him an instruction? You start your own institution. Apparently it seems there was no instruction like that. Yes. He said, you preach in English language, you write books. But it is Srila Prabhupada's understanding that if I go to the West and if I just write books and I distribute books, if the Western people who do not have an environment, who do not understand the culture, if they read these books, it is shocking to live by the principles that are mentioned in the Bhagavatam. It is shocking to live by the principles that are mentioned in the Gita. So, you know, they are already under stress, Maya-induced stress. This will put them... So it is very important to create an institution in which there will be a facility to live by the instructions that I am writing in my books. So although Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati never instructed Srila Prabhupada to start an institution, that is what Srila Prabhupada did when he reached US. Before completing the entire Bhagavatam, Prabhupada first started the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Then he started completing the rest of the Bhagavatam, the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the Krishna book and all other books. So this is very interesting. How an Acharya looks. The Acharya is saying, I want to carry out the order of my Guru Maharaj till my last moment. And that's what he did. On the bed on which he is translating purports. But to create a favorable environment for you and me to live by the books, he first created the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. It is only when we are in the association of devotees that these words will make sense. It is only in the association of good environment and good culture will there be inspiration. Yes, I am reading this shloka, but I am not just reading this shloka. I want to internalize this shloka. So I would say Srila Prabhupada understood this combination of environment and instructions in such an amazing way that he has given us a community, he has given us a society in which it's easy. So we have an inherent good potential within us, but that inherent good potential is not being subdued thanks to the society that Srila Prabhupada has created and his followers have created. It is easy to be a gentleman when we live in devotees. But if we get ungrateful about this association, if we leave this association, however good we may be, we can also fall prey to committing the most heinous crimes, thinking that, well, you know, this is what is necessary. The Milgram experiment, the Stanford prison, they got carried away. The good people got carried away. I would not take a risk myself. I'm very grateful to whatever Srila Prabhupada has given. And I would say, you know, this is something that we can learn, that Lord Shiva, when he got associated with Banasur, yes, Banasur served him in some way. He played mridang for Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva felt affection for him. Lord Shiva said, what do you want? He said, I want to become your devotee. And look at the situation where Shiva has landed himself. He's fighting with Lord Krishna. Why? Out of his association, affection for Banasur. What if, you know, Banasur, when he's playing mridang, Shiva says, you do what you want to do. Because you're not a good person, I'm never going to get pleased with you. Banasur would have gone away to please some other demigod. He's not interested in Shiva because he asked Parvati from Shiva. He just wanted some powerful person to grant him a benediction. Shiva became happy with that and he got his benediction. So Shiva is a good devotee. Brahma is a good devotee. Indra is a good devotee. But out of their association and in a cultureless environment, even the most good people can do wrong things. So we should take this as a lesson and we should try to keep ourselves not just in good instructions, not just become book readers, but also be grateful for the association in which we can read and practice these books. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavat Mahapurana ki jai.